If you need a very shorter version of the coasttocoastam.com website, just put this down as one of your favorites as well. Just CTOC.com. That's all you have to remember as well. Coasttocoastam.com or CTOC.com. Now get ready, because in a moment, we are going to conduct an interview and a chat with Daryl Sims. He's called the Alien Hunter. You'll find out why in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Daryl Sims is a certified master hypnotherapist. He is a certified hypnotic anesthetist, a certified master neuro-linguistic practitioner, and licensed private investigator in the state of Texas, and researcher of alleged human-slash-alien encounters. His discoveries of the alleged alien implantation and fluorescence found on abductees following reported contact by alien entities are but two finds that his medical scientific team explores. He is also an advisor investigator for the PARSEC, PARSEC organization. This is an Italian-based organization of medical doctors, physicists, psychotherapists, and other professionals who invited Sims to come on board in 2000 to use his skills to complete professional investigations in psychological and physical evidence in his work. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Daryl. How are you?
Hello, George. Good to be with you here.
And I was going to say, can we get you titles next time that we humans can pronounce properly? Yeah? I got through them all. I couldn't believe
that's
it.
Good. I've had a quite eclectic life, as you can imagine, and I've just about done everything there is to do. I guess that tells a little bit about my age.
How in the heck, with the background that you have, did you get involved in investigations of this strange UFO alien phenomenon?
Well, you might say I was a captive audience.
Yourself?
Yes, sir. That's comes as a bit of a surprise to a lot of people I speak to. In fact, I've had about 300 emails since the announcement of me being on your program tonight for the last 3 days, and with people who claim human-alien contact. Some of them are pretty amazing cases with good physical evidence. But the bottom line is that as my mother, who is 74 years old, just recently found out from watching TV, I'm an abductee myself. And it's not something that everybody needs to go out and tell everybody or introduce to your local pastor or to your church or whatever.
Well,
it's not going to help you.
She didn't know about this, Daryl, until she saw
my mother found out about it. My mother found out about it, George, on the, I believe it was the History Channel, when they were doing an interview. And they shot a program here in my home in Houston. And my mother said, I saw you on TV again. And I said, well, okay, you know, and she knew I did the investigations, but she said, Daryl, they said you were an abductee. I said, oh, my gosh. And my biggest skeptic of all people was my mother, and she stayed there for 2 hours questioning me as to how in the world I could remember all that stuff when I was a child. And I said, let me make it easy for you, Mom. Would you like me to tell you the address of our home at 1005 South K Street, Midland, Texas, when I was 4 years old, and the phone number?
Amazing, yeah.
Well, she backed off.
You're going to have to tell us what happened to you.
Well, in a nutshell, that's a...
Is it painful for you to talk about?
Not anymore. It was initially, because I had no idea what in the world was going on. I mean, I did not have a clue. You have to understand, this was 1952, so there aren't any, if there were any monster movies or something going on then that you could watch, my parents would have certainly never allowed me to do something like that.
Right.
That would just have never happened, and the event actually took place when I was 3 and a half. I use the word 4 because that tends to make it a little easier for folks. But the fact is, George, of course, now you have to understand, I've pieced this together after over 50 years of thinking about it and analyzing it as an investigator and not only as a child. So I would kind of like to give you very quickly the child's view and then the investigator's view
sure.
of the same event.
All right.
The child's view is very simple. And this is a term I use in a new book that I'm writing. It's a first book I've ever written in 38 years, and the reason I hadn't written one in 38 years because I didn't think we could make a case for abduction until now, and I think maybe we can.
You might be able to now. That's true.
So the bottom line is that I was for lack of a better term, switched on in the middle of the night. This event took place at night. I have had abductions that took place while I was hunting in broad daylight, while I was armed. So it doesn't make any difference. It wasn't sleep paralysis in either case. But the fact is that there, as I opened my eyes, I realized there was an entity standing in the room. He was tall for me, because I was only 4 years old. He's probably about 5 foot tall. He was pure white. He was not gray. He looked very similar to the entities that people often describe, very skinny, spindly. I couldn't see his knees or his feet, which also convinced me as an adult that I was not hallucinating, because if I was hallucinating, I could have easily imagined that.
Sure.
The fact is I didn't see the feet until later, and it shocked me because they weren't anything like I thought they, well, like a human. So as I looked at the entity, I began to think, what is that? And it apparently heard what I was thinking and paid very strict attention to me, and was about 8 or 10 feet away, I guess. And it had large black eyes that were perfectly
almond shaped, I guess.
They were round. No, yeah. That was the thing that when people first told me this stuff about aliens having these almond eyes, I thought they were making it up. I really did, because what I saw had perfectly round eyes. And when I went to Chile and told the same story, one lady was just scared. She came up afterward and said her events took place back in 1952 as well, and she described the same type entity.
Same thing. Big eyes? Were they big, though?
Large black eyes, yeah. Perfectly round. I've often been asked, what's the disparity between the two stories of the almond eyes and the round eyes? And my response was, well, perhaps, you know, I got to see the Ford model and you got to see the Lexus. I don't know.
Well, hey, look at Asians and look at people who aren't of that race.
It's just different, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a different model or what. But the thing was, I was not paralyzed. I could move, and I was moving. I wasn't afraid. I mean, there was nothing for me to be afraid about. What was amazing about that event was all children, little children, see things vastly different than adults. The first thing I noticed is he didn't have any clothes on, which didn't make any sense to me. This was wintertime, and it was very cold.
Now, I'm going to ask you something now, which I think is an important question that everybody probably is saying, okay, you got to ask him. Because here you are, a little boy, talking about a five-foot being in your room. You're small. How do you know, and I hate to ask you this, but I have to, how do you know this wasn't some kind of sexual abuse case?
Well, there's nothing wrong with asking the question, and certainly we have those questions on our questionnaire.
Oh, you do?
We look for that. Oh,
right.
Yes, we do. First of all, there has never been any sexual abuse in our family, and even in our family lineage that we have ever discovered.
You know, somebody got
in
broken
case,
in the house
it
or something.
It simply wasn't the case.
All right.
But because my best answer to that is it came back, and it came back for from age 4 to 17, for a little over 13 years, the entity, and several of them, actually, over a period of time, came back about every year or so.
All right.
And if, you know, doesn't make any sense, you're out hunting, you know, when you're 14 years old and the entity show up again, you know, this
sure.
Must be sexual abuse. I'm hunting.
Well, eventually you became mature enough to know exactly what these things were or what they looked like. So through the minds of a little kid, as you said, might be totally different from through the minds of an adult.
Sure. So for me as a child, the first thing I noticed is it didn't have any clothes. And the next thing you would notice as a little child is it didn't have a TT.
All right.
Now, that just floored me, because you have to have something. I mean, I had a little sister, and it was me, and there were just two kids in the family. I mean, that was it. It didn't have any mammary glands. It didn't have a belly button, a navel. So to me, I couldn't understand why it didn't have what we had.
Could have been a robot.
I didn't understand that. So what I did grasp about that was that, as an investigator, when I see that whole story, I see something vastly different. I see an entity that, if real, of course, and one always has to question that, if it is real, then the entity obviously was not born.
It's a good point.
It's obviously not born because it has no mammary glands, has no mm-hmm. no genitalia, and no nothing to procreate with, so to speak. So that would cause the entity, if real, and that has to be thrown in the mix. If he's real, then he probably is cloned, hatched, or manufactured,
or
maybe even a combination.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and you're saying that these episodes happen to you almost on a yearly basis through what age?
Up till I was 17 years old.
And then they just abruptly stopped?
They abruptly stopped with an abduction event that ended violently. It was my last event, and I was traumatized by the last event, but I was also elated because nothing ever happened for years after. So I never bothered to tell my wife or anyone because, I mean, let's face it, if it's not happening anymore, who cares, and why bring up trouble? And then my son experienced abduction about age 5. And
so it started all over again.
It started all over again. And it's in the family lineage, and it is in most family lineages where abductees are at. So it's not just your imagination. It's others in your family.
This traumatized event, which ended your abductions, was it done by the same beings that you had known all along?
It wasn't at all. That was, first of all, what surprised me. And it's a long story, and in fact, we'll actually go through that I'm actually writing two books, one on the anatomy of an abduction, and the first one that'll come out will be on fluorescence, which is bringing the evidence from the visible to the invisible. But basically, the best way to say this is that the entity showed up in the last event weren't anything like anything I've even heard of in the UFO phenomena, and which again made little sense to me. I went to my girlfriend the next day and told her about the event, and she looked at me. I'm from Texas, so I'm going to use a Texas terminology here, like a calf looking at a new gate. They just stand there and look at it like, you know, what is that?
What is that? Yeah.
And she looked at me for a long time and knew that never lied to her, never tell her anything inappropriate. And so she took me to a friend of mine who was doing scientific anomaly studies with me. He was a psychologist, and he was a buddy, a friend, and also my school teacher. So I thought, well, great, you know, maybe he'll have all these great answers for me. So I go over and sit down and tell him the whole story. And he's looking at me like a calf looking at a new gate.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, now, Daryl, now you and I both know that the UFOs exist because, you know, this is New Mexico. A lot of people see this stuff out here, and we've seen it, and blah, blah, blah. But if that's really happening, like you're saying, well, it couldn't be like that. It's they're going to land like on the White House lawn. And I said, hey, I saw the movie. Whatever it is we think about these entities, it's not anything like we imagined. They're not like anything we can imagine. And whatever they are, it's not anything like they're portraying in the movies. And I said, I know, and then I told him the whole story. I said, I've been experiencing this since I was, you know, 4 years old. And he just was white as a sheet because, again, you know, we're buddies, and I'd never lie to him. So I never described these entities to anyone in the last event, nor the particulars of the event. And the reason I didn't is because I wanted to see if other people, as a control for me.
Sure, I understand.
Would see if they've had, because, I mean, if you told this whole story, I mean, in detail out there, I guarantee I'd have 500 people write me emails. Oh, yeah, me too.
Me too.
Mine
right.
was exactly. Well, that's great. Since you just had that, you can just describe all of it, the events and the entities, which don't look like anything in the UFO phenomenon.
It's like a crime scene where the police do not want to reveal everything to the media, because if they ever do talk to a suspect, they want to see if he knows something about that crime scene that nobody else knows.
That's exactly correct. So I've kept that information, and what I have found, again, one has to be realistic and wonder even about your own experiences. I don't care how valid they are to you. So I have, after working over 1,000 cases worldwide, I do a lot of public speaking every year around the world, and will again this year. I have found 8 people so far who have had virtually the identical event.
Same kind of beans.
Same
everything.
Entities. I'll give you an example. I was keynoting a conference in Los Angeles, I think in 94 or 95. Mm-hmm. And I had a big display with a lot of the implants and a lot of things I had there. And this real tall black fella is a very handsome looking guy. I mean, real powerful imagery. He keeps walking around my display at a distance for 2 days. And I think, well, what in the world? Usually these are abductees that are not going to tell you anything.
Sure.
And finally, the last day, I'm about 6 o'clock in the evening, I'm taking everything down, and there's no one around. And all of a sudden, I sense somebody's around me, and I look over, and there he is again. And he says, Mr. Sims? And I said, yes, sir. I'd never met him before. He knew me. And he says, I want to ask you a question, sir. And I said, please do, sir. And he took his pen out and started drawing this entity, which was my guy. And he said, I want to know if you've ever seen this. I took the pen out of his hand and finished it. And he said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And he just started running and left his pen there. I mean, he just took off, just horrified. And the problem is with these particular entities in this last event, it's not like other events at all. They're quite violent. And if you could describe them, the best way to describe it is if the alien wasn't what we thought it was,
yeah,
let's suppose it were like an intelligence community, or this would be like the Gestapo of that.
Yeah. I mean, the torture of whatever.
Well, I had to question myself on my own event at age 17. And, of course, sleep paralysis come to mind, and 14 other answers. You know, you made it up, you sleepwalk. I never sleptwalked in my life, never. And I know the answers thousand times over.
Garrett, can you safely say that there are benevolent entities and malevolent entities?
I can safely say that concerning the malevolence, that I've got 2 dead children in Dallas, Texas, as a result of their abductions. I can give you case after case of, and I don't have to, for those who want, if they prefer me not to be as good a source as possible, then the quite famous Bob Pratt wrote a wonderful book called UFO Danger Zone, 10 years of work down in the Amazon basin, where the Amazonian Indians were attacked for over 10 years by the Chupa Chupas, UFOs that came up, refrigerator-sized UFOs that came up out of the Amazon River. And this is a matter of record. And according to Jacques Vallée, that Bob Pratt's work was some of the finest field work he had ever seen. So that speaks on itself. The question is, I think for your audience, is are there the good guys out there, good entities? Well, of course there are, in my opinion. And if you're a Christian, you have to go along with the idea that there are at least if a third of them are bad, there's got to be 2/3 that are good. But the question is, are these entities we're talking about the same as angelic or this sort of thing? And my response is that they are not. The fact is that in the famous Calvin Parker case, and
hold that right there. We'll talk about that case when we come right back. I'm George Norrie, Daryl Sims, our guest, the Alien Hunter, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you live in the Los Angeles area, circle your calendar February 11th. I'll be at the Los Angeles Hilton. There's a major Conscious Life Expo, and I'm going to be out there that Saturday around 3 o'clock or so. You can go to their website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. All All right, we're talking with investigator and abductee Daryl Sims. Daryl, you were going to tell us a story of a what, Calvin Clark?
Calvin Parker.
Parker, okay.
Famous Calvin Parker case. I know Calvin quite well, and years ago I spoke with him, and I was amazed to have him tell me privately of another event that he had in which there was something far different happened in the event. And in three events that I've investigated in my years of investigations of abductions worldwide, I've found in three cases angelic beings showing up to interfere with the abduction. Now, this is by and large very rare for this even to be reported. And in the cases that where they reported, there was is a good indication that the individuals were truthful. What's fascinating about in each of the three stories is that when the angelic entity show up, the angel shows up, the alien entities take off in the other direction as fast as they can get out of Dodge.
Now, that's interesting. Almost as if there's some kind of evil surrounding this.
Well, what they do, well, the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned, and in fact, Bob Bigelow, the famous billionaire, called me home one time, and he had a group of doctors and professors and others with him on the line. And he asked me a question. He says, "You seem to be able to acquire physical evidence others have not been able to do, and I want to know why." And I said, "Well, sir, it has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that I'm just a hunter." He said, "I don't understand." I said, "Well, if you understand the nature of hunting, you understand that a hunter or a trapper knows his quarry, his prey. That's why he's successful. If he isn't, then he's going to starve to death. All Native Americans who were in the, if they weren't agrarians and were hunters, they had to be good at this or they simply starved. They just wouldn't have existed. By the same token, I said, I was the quarry for a long time, for 13 years. And these entities hunted me, and they found me easily. They found me easy to catch because I have habits, just like animals do. What I later found out, and I told Mr. Bigelow the same thing, I said, what I later found out was simply that these entities have habits too. And I've discussed this with a number of investigators, and they ultimately will come around to the same conclusion, because once an individual starts telling you an honest-to-goodness real abduction event, I don't care where it is in the world, you can almost tell them what it's going to be like, because they follow the same program. They're so similar, it's just amazing.
What are they looking for, Daryl? What do they want to do?
Well, what we've been able to do is to come up with some, how do you say it, for lack of a better term, some stats, basically, that kind of give us a feel for maybe what they're up to, because the entities simply won't tell you. In many cases, they simply lie. We've had as many as eight different stories told to eight people on the same mass abduction on December 8th, 1992, and all of them were told eight different stories. Now, if you're a police officer and you come into a criminal scene and you have eight witnesses and all eight witnesses tell you eight totally different stories, at least seven of them are going to jail for lying to a police officer. I used to be a cop. I'm telling you, this is the way it's going down.
Yeah.
But basically, so what we had to do is just kind of go backwards at this instead of try to say, well, what are they up to? We don't know. I mean, we don't know who they are or what, you know, so we're gathering evidence. Basically, what we did find is that 45% of the people that we worked with, and this is amazing, our Native American, Indian, Irish, Celtic.
45%? 45%. That's unusual.
We were shocked. And a case in point is a lady called from South Dakota, and she told me her amazing story of her and her two children. And the neighbors even called and said, "There's a large disc-like object over your home. You know, are you okay?" She's scared and crying and shouting. And I said, "Well, tell me your genetic background." She said, "Well, now I'm Sioux. Of course, I'm Lakota." And I said, "Don't get smart with me. Answer the questions. You called me, remember?" She said, "Well, I'm Sue." I said, "Are you anything else?" She says, Well, that's weird that you should ask. My granddad is a redheaded Irishman.
So you were looking for that 45%,
exactly.
Almost 50%.
That's really strange. Well, we're not sure what all this means, but we're still collating a lot of it.
Okay.
31% of these people have rare drug allergies to procaines. Xylocaine, Novocaine, Lidocaine, cocaine, any of the cane family.
Allergies to them.
Rare drug allergies. Now, the allergies are twofold. They go in two directions. One is an allergy to the drug itself. The other one is a resistance. And how I found out about this was when I first went to a dentist. I never had any teeth problems at all. I mean, ever. And I mean, I think I went to my dentist the first time when I was like 21 years old. And he said, "Well, you got great teeth." And I said, "Thank you." And I said, "I think I've got a cavity here." And he said, "Yeah, I can see that." And so he said, "Well, I'll give you a shot of this." And I said, "Okay." So he gives me a shot of Novocaine. And he said, "Well, we'll give you another one." And he gave me another one. And he gave me a third one. And he said, "Well, I'm telling you," he said, that does it. And he hit me with that drill, and I nearly jumped clean out of the chair.
It didn't work. And did your face
blow up? So the only way I've ever been able to go to the dentist is to literally put myself in an hypnotic state and just let them do whatever they're going to do.
No, now let me ask you, though. Of that 31% that seems to be allergic to this, what do you think the norm percent would be?
It's a good thing that you ask. It is so rare that if you tell your dentist, and I challenge anybody to do this, go tell your dentist that I am allergic to
Novocaine,
or any of the cane family. They'll laugh at you. They'll say the allergy is so rare that we don't even check for it. Case in point, my senior investigator told his ophthalmologist that he said, "That's a procaine in that stuff you're going to put on my eye," isn't it? And he says, "Yes." He said, "It'll relax your eye." I said, "Well, I'm allergic to it." And he says, "Dale, we never worry about that." And he put it on his eye, and Dale fell over in coma.
Okay.
You can imagine the problems.
So 31% of the people here
are
allergic.
About one out of every 1,200 are going to have any kind of anything from mild allergies to, hives.
Have you come to any conclusions why they're selecting these people, then, who have these allergies?
I suspect it's the stuff they're giving them that's causing them to react over a period of years.
That might be.
That's the only thing I can come up with.
That might be.
I don't know. 35% of abductees that we've collated report surgical work and or some type of implantation or procedure done on them that they feel like that was invasive. 62% of women report a missing fetus or gynecological anomaly. 63% of men report an unusual lump, surgical cut or needle-like punctures or sharp pain in the testicles during their period of their abductions, which causes a period of sexual dysfunction for about 6 months to a year.
6 months to a year?
Yes. 54% have nosebleeds for unknown reasons. One of them is a medical doctor here in Houston, by the way. He can't figure out why. He said, "I live in a high-rise building. This doesn't make any sense. I keep having these weird dreams of being out in the woods with these bald-headed little creatures with these large bug eyes. It didn't make any sense." And he's just freaking out. Wow. He says, "I live in a high-rise building. This is impossible, and I can't stop my nose from bleeding."
Has he been tested for implants?
He talks to me through his nurse, who talks to my nurse.
Your nurse talks to my nurse, right?
That's exactly it. Because, he said, if this ever got out, he said, "Mr. Sims, I would be ruined." He said, "I'm in the who's who in the medical community in Houston. This is never going to get out." Well, I agreed with him, and we have a number of people, including three NASA scientists that are abductees. So this idea that it happens to these little housewives and people who have too little to do and watching TV too much and little kitties who simply don't get it or get too much sugar in their diet, these people are just definitely wrong.
What have you ascertained, Daryl? What have you ascertained about the implants? What is their purpose?
Well, this is not going to make some of your people out there happy. I have never told anyone to date what an implant was, in my view, based on all that I've discovered about them, simply because for several reasons. One of the big reasons was that I wanted to see where this thing would go, and especially the real stuff, and then, of course, the phony stuff. And of course, a lot of stuff is on the internet about implants that is just off the wall and not even remotely close. The fact is that the implanted object, first of all, for your audience, and this is very important, and please, everybody out there is listening, because I've got a lot of emails on this. Implants are extremely rare. I mean extremely rare. And I just don't want people running out there thinking, oh, my God, you know, I must have this big implant somewhere, and there's an implant in my brain or whatever. Mm-hmm. These things are so rare. And for us to have evidence of any kind is extremely rare for a lot of reasons. Number one is the abductee is programmed to destroy their own evidence, and they will consistently. So to even get any kind of evidence is amazing in itself.
Yet you've been able to do that.
Yes, sir. Dr. Alan Hynek actually was one of the first people to notice possibility of implantation in the early 80s. He learned this from a case in Brazil that he found out through an MD that was there. How I discovered it from my own self was, was age 12, 1960, 1305 Ohio Street in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And it's another abduction story. Again, I was switched on. I wasn't sleepwalking. I'm wide awake. I thought I heard my mother, because it sounded like her voice, and this is just part of the program, some of the stuff they do. I walked outside, saw a hugely bright star. I mean, this thing was huge. It was about 3 in the morning or 3 or 4 in the morning. It was quite late, and it was pretty cold. And I'm standing out there in my little shorts, my little T-shirt, and as a young kid, 12 years old.
The desert cold.
And it is cold at night.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, this light gets very bright real quick, and it's kind of like in the movie Phenomenon, where that thing just, the light got real bright, and then boom, next thing you know, he's out. Well, the next thing I notice is I'm inside this circular room, lying on this table with my feet elevated about 11 degrees. And there's a bright light over me, and the light is so bright and intense that I get the feeling, and I didn't try it or anything, but I got the feeling that the light was, and for lack of a better term, slowed down, as if you could stick your hand outside it and you might not even be able to see it or something. The light just wasn't right. I couldn't understand why it was there, and I looked over, and there was that same entity that was there when I was... He's there every time, and he's getting instructions from someone that's outside the light itself. It's pretty direct. It's coming from a device. At that point, there's about a 9-inch needle-like object with a little silver light ball on the end of it. It's inserted in my nasal passage and jammed in there. There was no suggestion, no Novocaine or no anything. It was extremely painful. I remember screaming. It hurt so bad. It broke the bones.
Probably still remember the screaming and the pain.
I do for a fact. And the next morning, of course, woke up with blood on my pillow. And now I have a pretty good idea why the blood was on the pillow.
Yeah. Did you ever get that implant out of you?
I've even had a full body scan, one from a car wreck back in 1980 when I had a corporation truck ran into me. I've had all kinds of things and had head scans and all kinds of things just to check, and I've not found the object. What I have found is two things happen in these alleged abduction experiences where an implantation supposedly takes place, like mine. Is number one, the objects sometimes will expel themselves, or the body will reject them, or they'll just get kicked out for whatever reason.
And what size is it? Is it like
this one was extremely small. This was so small.
Smaller than a pea, I guess, right?
It was about the size of a fourth the size of a BB. And since then, we found a little girl that had eight little tiny gold spheres, four at a time, in her nasal passage. After her abduction, she told her mom, and her mom came to a workshop that I was speaking at, where I was teaching people how to find and look for evidence so they could do this by themselves. And the mother had attended that, and the little girl had told her a story that the little men came into my room and what the strange eyes and all this, and so they did this thing to my nose, and her mother had her sneeze into the Kleenex over and over until she said, "You're not going to believe this." She said, "I found four little gold spheres."
Huh.
And I said, "Well, what size are they? She said, they're about the size of a pinhead. She said, they're little tiny things. Well, she got to playing around with them, cleaned them off, and they fell off into the carpet, and she lost them. They're that small.
No.
A few days later, the entities came back and did it again, four more in, and she got those and sent them to me, and I got them, and I've started testing them.
Are those the pictures that we've seen on the website
are.
That you sent us?
Okay. Yes.
Now, when you tell us you're testing them, explain what you're doing.
Well, one of the things we do is we have some pretty strict rules for testing for what we do. Number one, we prefer that it not be UFO-related people, because the first bullet that's fired at you, so to speak, is going to be, well, you use UFO scientists. No wonder you come up with those kind
right,
of results.
Right.
So we send them to independent universities and others who volunteer to help us,
okay.
Doctors and others who have no axe grind. In fact, some of them are pretty against this sort of thing. So that's what I want, because I can't use any evidence that's tainted. I can't use it could be, it might be. I have to know exactly what it is or isn't.
Are these like nano? They're bigger than nanos, but I mean, they might have all kinds of circuitry inside of them.
Well, let me back up a little bit and again bring you into the sphere where I live with this implant business. In 1994. I was giving a conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and a doctor called me from California, San Francisco area, and he says, would you come do a presentation to John Muir Medical Hospital? I said, on what? And he says, on your work. I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, this is an AMA-sponsored program for continuing education for surgeons.
Well, they were dead serious, weren't they?
I don't think they had an idea what I was going to speak on. He says, what's your subject? I said, well, medical complications of alleged human-alien contact. This worked for me. So I went there, and all I did was, of course, present all artifacts, and especially x-rays and CAT scans, you know, all the appropriate things that you would do for medical people. I didn't go, and I told him, I said, I'm not here to convince you that the alien phenomena exist, nor am I here to convince you of any of that. All I'm here to do is to ask you to do two things. One is to prove me wrong. That's what you, based in
about what you were showing them.
You should. And I said, and here's how you do it. And I brought two women up there who were abductees from the area. They told their story. And I said, so whenever these people come to you like this and tell you these stories, and they have these unusual lumps or bumps and different little manifestations that I've shown you here in these presentations, what I would like for you to do is to, instead of just opening this up and taking a biopsy to see if it's malignant or not, please examine the tissue a little further. Because if these objects really are installed by the alien entity,
mm-hmm.
And I said, and I don't know what an alien is, and I still don't. I just know they're entities of some kind. I said, what we'll find, first of all, and later we did in our surgeries, you're going to find, first of all, that these objects will show no signs of inflammatory response, either chronic or acute. Well, of course, that just is not going to happen. I mean, if you get a splinter, guess what? You're going to
get a little infection.
You're going to get it. The body's either going to eat it or it's going to remove it.
Yep.
That's all.
Stay with us, Darryl. I want to talk more about this with you, and then we're going to find out how you got the title, The Alien Hunter. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.